So actually, I'm going to talk a little bit more generally about sequencing. Since I don't, have you had any previous lectures about how sequence data is generated or anything like that?
In principle.
Okay, then I'll go through that very quickly. I do have a couple of overheads that I wanted to show as well. So anyway, so you know basically what the principles behind Sanger sequencing is. The idea is to carry out, you start with a single-stranded DNA template, or you can use a double-stranded template if you... In a second, yeah, we could get it set up now. Just want to show an example of a sequencing read. And then you carry out reactions, generally four different reactions that generate fragments, single-stranded fragments that all start at the same point in a strand complementary to the template, and proceed to different occurrences of a particular nucleotide. So here's an example. We've got a primer sequence here. This is your template DNA strand. DNA polymerase inserts nucleotides one by one, and some fraction of the time when it puts in an A, it will put in a chain terminating version of an A and therefore stop the chain. But sometimes it puts in the normal form of the A nucleotide and the chain extends. So that's the principle. And then you resolve the strands by gel electrophoresis. In so-called automated sequencing, at least in the form that ABI, Applied Biosystems, the machinery implements, you label the synthesized strands with a fluorescent dye. There are four different dyes corresponding to the four different nucleotides. The four different nucleotide reactions. The dye can be attached either to the primer or to the terminating nucleotide. And then with the fragments corresponding to the four different nucleotides all labeled differently, you can run them in the same gel lane or capillary tube and then and detect the fragments using a laser detector. It's quite possible to resolve fragments of sizes up to 1,000 bases or even a little bigger than that, although typically the data quality does start to degenerate towards the end of the read, and most reads are more in these days in the range of 500 to 700 bases long. But the new capillary machines have very high throughput. They can process 96 samples at a time, so you get 96 reads at a time in 2 to 3 hour runs, or at least I'm not sure they're yet attaining the run lengths of that short a length, but that's the goal, is to be able to get a run every 2 hours. So in principle, you could have 10 runs a day, 12 runs a day.
And why would you want to have the dye attached to the primer?
It gives the main reason for continuing to use the dye primer chemistry is it gives a little better data quality. When you attach the dye to the terminating nucleotide, it creates problems for the polymerase because it's dealing with this modified nucleotide that has a big side group with the dye attached to it, and that, so the data quality tends to be poor.
The primer at the beginning of every partial sequence.
That's right.
And so I don't quite understand. I'm missing some very elementary. The color. Is it has special color associated with it?
Yeah. So in the A reaction, yes. So you carry out four different reactions. And for each of those reactions, the primer would be labeled with a different dye. And it could be attached anywhere. And I'm actually not even sure where. I believe it's probably attached at the first nucleotide of the primer. But
the primer knows the base pair that it's terminating.
Right.
So
And well, it only knows that if you mix up your primers and the other components of your sequencing reaction, you can get garbage. But, one nice thing about labeling the terminating nucleotides is that in principle you can carry out all the reactions in the same tube, so you get more efficiency there. Whereas if the dye is attached to the primer, you can't do that. You have to keep the reactions separate. So at any rate, sequencing capacities have really skyrocketed the last few years due to these capillary machines. The templates that you use for sequencing can, in principle, be any clone DNA fragment. And usually what's done is you use a primer, so-called universal primer, that's complementary to the vector sequence immediately adjacent to the insert. So the insert is a new piece of DNA that you want to derive the sequence from, and initially you don't know anything about it, but the primer is complementary to the vector sequence, and then the fragments that you generate extend into the insert, so you derive sequence from the insert. So this is simplest to do because you can use the same primer for every clone. On the other hand, it's also possible to generate sequence in a more directed fashion using custom primers that you synthesize in the lab that are complementary to a known part of the insert, and then you can get additional sequence from the immediately adjacent part where you might not know the sequence. So both those strategies are used. And then another technical innovation that's turned out to be useful is that you can generate vector primed reads from both ends of the insert, just reading in opposite directions into the insert. And this gives you in addition to the read information, it gives you information about approximate spacing and relative orientations of these two different reads. I just wanted to show an example. You might have seen an example already of what part of a sequencing trace looks like. This is, it's upside down. But what's shown here is parts of two different reads. Here's part near the beginning of one read, and what you see is a series of peaks. The data has actually already been fairly heavily processed at this point, but the point is it gives you get the fluorescence profile readout from your laser detector gives you, in essence, a series of peaks. And they're four different colors corresponding to the four different bases. The main point I wanted to make here is that there's quite a bit of variation in the data quality. This is actually very old data generated at a time when read lengths were not as long as they are now. And here we're out at around base 400 or so in the read, and as you can see, the peaks are quite a bit broader. It's not clear in all places, in fact, how many peaks there are, because peaks for the same nucleotide tend to run together. You do have noise, false peaks, which are not always clearly distinguishable from true ones. This is a genuine A peak, but it's only about as big as some of the noise peaks, and so forth. And
so what is the meaning of the multiple rows
up here?
Just in the bottom.
This is taken from a display of our sequence editing program, CONSED, and it shows the base calls from our program, FRED, the ABI software base calls, and the calls that are to be edited. And this is a consensus sequence generated from the assembly. So you've got several reads lined up in the assembly, and this is the best guess at the underlying sequence, taking into account all the read information. It does, yeah. We now use the gray scale. It's shown up here is used in preference to the case, but the gray scale here indicates data quality. I'm not going to talk in detail about this, but basically the white background indicates higher quality, low error probability base calls, and the grayer and blacker backgrounds indicate lower quality data, higher error probability.
Okay.
Yeah. Increased read lengths are certainly desirable, but you do run into inherent limitations. I mean, if you really could generate 10,000 base pair reads, that would, and they were highly accurate, that would be great. But no one can do that. I mean, the peaks it's partly an issue. You're trying to resolve. It's already impressive to me that you can clearly distinguish a fragment of size 500 from one of size 501. If you go up to 10,000, it's an even smaller percentage difference. The run has to be longer to get to that point, which means that diffusion becomes an issue. Also, just the sequencing reaction itself. If you think of the incorporation efficiency of the polymerase, it's what you expect is sort of a geometric decay in the signal strength, because to get a fragment of a certain length, you have to put in non-terminating nucleotides at every point up to that position, and put in a chain terminator, and so the signal gets weaker and weaker. So you're fighting all of those things basically as you try to increase read length.
Are there technologies like Stanford?
Yeah. Well, somebody obviously has hope in them. I'm not sure I do. there are various sort of blue sky kinds of approaches that may work out. But I mean, the initial hope, this is very old technology. In essence, the Sanger sequencing was invented in the 70s. And this newer version is all incremental improvements, improved labeling, improved gels, and so forth. I think the hope at the start of the Genome Project was that some of these more speculative technologies would come through and they would dramatically lower the cost of sequencing, and that those would actually be what would be used to generate the human genome sequence. And none of those panned out. I mean, some of them still have promise. But it's basically the same old technology. The capillaries is an improvement, but again, it's still a gel inside a capillary, so really all these improvements are incremental, and they have however lowered the price substantially to the point where it actually did become possible using the old technology to sequence the human genome at less than the originally predicted cost. So. I think it's hopeless. So sequencing by hybridization is this method of where you put oligonucleotides on a chip, and then you take the template that you're interested in sequencing. Generally, you amplify it by PCR, and you hybridize it to the chip, and basically see which oligonucleotides it hybridizes to. So conceptually, that's actually like shotgun sequencing, except the hybridization data are the sort of the random subsequences. You detect whether or not they're present in your sequence, but there are a lot of issues. The data quality is poor. And beyond that, if you've got repeats in your sequence, and you do in in any reasonable size sequence, you get a fundamental ambiguity in trying to resolve the order. So the sequencing by hybridization, I think its main use in sequencing these days is in resequencing projects where you've already got a basic reference sequence and you're interested in looking at a bunch of samples from different individuals or from very closely related species that may have slight differences at isolated positions. And then you can use the interplay between the known reference sequence and the hybridization data to find out what the variations are. But I think pretty much everybody's given up on it as an idea for really doing de novo sequencing. Well, no, with slab gels, people were getting that kind of resolution. It comes from a variety of technical improvements, using very thin gels, using improved polymerases, and better signal detection. It is a big increase, and actually read length is a key parameter in sequencing projects. You get a lot of information from having longer reads. You're more likely to be able to read through repeats, and it gives you, you know, contiguity at a bigger level in your initial data. So it's actually quite important. It's possible that may come along. People are doing some. The data accuracy is not what you would like, and the read lengths are not what you would like yet. But it's coming along, and it's possible that'll become an important technique. And there are also some techniques, single molecule kinds of techniques that may conceivably could work out, but there's a lot of work to do there. I mean, I think basically this is going to be the technology of choice for quite a while, but some of these other ones may eventually displace it. Certainly, if we want to get to the point, I mean, people have talked about, Wally Gilbert used to talk about sometime in the future when you could walk into a dime store and pay a dollar and get your entire genome sequence immediately. I'm not sure that's ever going to happen, but if it is going to happen, it can't be done using this technology. It'll have to be something radically new. You actually don't need to turn that off, I think, because I can just. All right, so so just this sort of I've already made some of these points that the read length and accuracy are affected by a number of factors, efficiencies of incorporation, which can be affected by things like strand secondary structure. The strand that you're synthesizing can sometimes fold up and stop the polymerase dead in its tracks. Sequence context has some effect. If you have long runs of a single nucleotide, frequently you get inaccurate sequence downstream because the newly synthesized strand does not pair accurately. It slips back and forth. Resolution of large fragments is sort of a fundamental issue with this approach, with resolving fragments by gel electrophoresis. And then you have artifacts that are generally called compressions, where the fragments are okay, but when you run them through the gel, some of the fragments fold up into particular secondary structures, particularly hairpin loops, which cause them to migrate with an aberrant mobility, and so peaks get displaced from where they should be. Yeah. Well, first of all, DNA it's not as bendable as RNA. So generally, the sequence has a big impact. The gel is at a reasonably high temperature, usually, and which tends to inhibit secondary structure formation. You actually put chemicals in the gel to try to inhibit secondary structure formation. And so you can largely get rid of, most of the, you know, most of the secondary structure formation, but not all generally. So it remains something of an issue. Actually, with a dye terminator labeling, it appears that the dye molecule, well, this seems to be less prone to this particular type of artifact. Apparently, I mean, one hypothesis is that the dye molecule itself actually interferes with the formation of the hairpin loop. But there are other possible explanations for that as well. But anyway, so the chemistry you use does have some impact on that. But in general, you generally get at least 500 bases at a very high accuracy, 99%. So the basic data you're getting from the reads is quite accurate. It does degrade in quality as you get out. If you're doing very long reads, 1,000 base pairs or more, the quality or the accuracy may drop out towards the end to 90 or 80% or below. And so at some point, it doesn't really make sense to continue getting more data because the accuracy has degraded too much. One thing we've focused on early on was getting driving error probabilities for the base calls. And I'll just show you the basic ideas. What we basically do is measure certain aspects of the trace, including looking for unresolved or places where peaks are not clearly resolved from each other, places where in the trace where the spacing is non-uniform, or where the relative sizes of uncalled peaks and called peaks are close to each other. And basically use these three parameters to compute. Well, we take a big set of training data, measure these parameters at each position in each trace, in each read, and compute and couple that to an empirically measured error rate for bases with those characteristics to basically get a way get a lookup table that takes you from values of the trace parameters to predicted error rate. And then we use that as to assign error probabilities to base calls in new data. And that actually works pretty well and has become pretty widely used. It's very useful in sequence assembly, as I'll mention in a second. Can I just? I can leave that up. Okay. For sequencing large, since you can only get maybe up to 1,000 bases at a time, if you want to get sequences of longer regions, and generally the regions you're interested in are much longer than that, you have to use some strategy that will enable you to get multiple reads and put them together. So the predominant strategy, and again, this is early in the genome project, there was a lot of argument about this. People thought of this method of sequencing as inherently efficient, and they tried to come up with all sorts of very directed strategies for getting the sequence data, so with fewer reads. But all of those are basically lost out. The basic shotgun sequencing, because of the simplicity of the operations, remains the strategy of choice. So the idea is You start with the initial DNA segment you're interested in, which might be an entire genome, or it might be a large clone of 100,000, 150,000 base pairs or so. Then you subclone that into smaller pieces and get reads from those subclones, and you get these to a high degree of redundancy, such that basically every base in your original DNA segment is represented in multiple different reads, and typical redundancies are seven or eight fold redundant. Even at that high level of redundancy, there are typically gaps that remain and regions where the data quality is unacceptably low. And so in a more directed fashion, you get reads specifically to close gaps and to improve the low quality regions. So in thinking about the effect of redundancy and what it gives you, there are some simple formulas that are credited to Lander and Waterman, although I think actually the basic ideas were much older than that in the statistical literature. But at any rate, let me just go through those since they're trivial to derive. Basically, let's suppose you've got a clone or a whole genome that's of size G base pairs. You generate a number N of randomly located reads by subcloning, and when you subclone, you lose all information about where the read is, and we'll assume that they're basically uniformly sampled from the genome or clone. And let's, for simplicity, although you don't really need it, assume that they're all the same read length, L. Then the coverage is just the total amount of sequence you generate in all the reads divided by the genome size. The fraction of the genome that's not covered is, I think it's easy to see what's going on here, but if you have a point in the genome, then a read does not cover it if and only if the left edge of that read is at least upstream of the point, or it's at L bases or more downstream. So the probability that an individual read will not cover it is 1 minus the fraction of the genome in that little segment of size L. So it's 1 minus L over G. The probability that that none of the reads cover it is that to the nth power, which is just e to the minus c. And then the number of contigs is going to be the number of right ends of reads, or you could obviously do the same argument with left ends, but it's the number of right read ends that are not covered by any other read. And so that's just the number of reads, which is the number of right ends, times the probability that any one of them is not covered.
A contig
is it's a contiguous sequence that's obtained by overlapping reads. And I should be making a little bit of adjustment here to take into account the fact that you can't detect the overlap unless it's at least a certain size. You can't reliably detect it, but I'm ignoring that. Then the average contig size is just going to be the total amount of DNA covered divided by the number of contigs, which works out to this. Typically, when you're sequencing a region, you want to get read data from both strands. You want to get reads going in both directions, mainly because the kinds of data artifacts that occur are generally present on one strand or the other at a given site, but not both. So you get more accurate sequence by covering both strands. So really, in thinking of terms of coverage of each strand, the nominal depth has to be halved. If you have 8x total read coverage, which is a lot, seems like a lot, It's still only 4x on each strand, and so the contigs are on each strand are not as big as you might think. The gap frequency when you're looking at an individual strand is more frequent than you might think. So anyway, 7 or 8x, if you just plug in the number, 7 or 8x coverage should give you virtually complete coverage of the genome. It's well over 99.999%. And the contig sizes are even on each strand are reasonably high. Actually, at 4x contig sizes, 4x coverage, the average contig size is about, this works out to about 13 times the read length. So if you had 500 base reads, that would be about 6.5 kb. So that's considered generally adequate for the shotgun phase, and then you finishing, you have to fill in those gaps, but it typically does not leave you a huge amount of work for each back. Okay, so the assembly problem is to actually reconstruct how the reads do overlap so that you can deduce the underlying sequence. And that is typically thought of as having three parts. The first is to find the potential pairwise overlaps by comparing the reads to each other. So these will be candidates for pairs of reads that are from the same region in the original sequence and overlap each other. Then using the pairwise overlaps, you try to construct the layout, the pattern of true overlaps of the reads. And once you have the layout, the third step is to make your best guess at the underlying sequence, which is frequently done by taking a consensus using all the read information that you have at a particular point. So you may have 7 or 8 reads on average if you've done 7 or X. Shotgun depth coverage, and you want to combine that information to get the best your best guess at the underlying sequence. So I thought there's a very simple idea for it seems to me not as widely known as it should be, but the problem of finding perfect sequence matches is actually quite easy. And when you're comparing reads, because they're so accurate, on average, finding joins, finding overlaps, basically reduces to finding long, perfectly matching segments. There'll be some, you generally don't have perfect overlaps due to the base calling errors, but you can expect to have 20, 25 or so bases in a stretch that that do perfectly match. So the idea for finding perfectly matching sequences between reads is can be formulated as follows. It's just the basic idea is you make a list. Well, initially think of a single sequence, and you want to find all occurrences of all perfectly matching subsequences of a given length within that sequence. Just make a list of pointers to all positions in the sequence, sort them lexicographically. And then that will give you. Yeah, I'll explain here. So here's the idea. Let's say you start with this sequence. You want to find all repeated subsequences. Make pointers to that point to each location in the sequence, and we think of that pointer as defining a string that starts at the position it points to and extends all the way to the end of the sequence. So then what we're going to do is just compare all these strings to each other and sort them. And lexicographically just means basically in alphabetical order, where you first compare the first nucleotide in the strings. If those are the same, then you proceed to the second one, and so forth. So it's just dictionary order. And here's the sorted list, and sorting can be done very efficiently. And once you have sorted the pointers, then basically any perfectly occurring subsequence you're going to find in adjacent in the list. So for example, here, these two pointers are adjacent. You've got ACT occurring in both of them. And so just by working through the list and looking at the beginnings of the reads or the beginnings of the strings to see see where the perfect matches, see how much of them match perfectly, you can find all occurrences of a word of a given length.
Can you iterate this somehow, or
no, you don't. I mean, once you've got the list, it's basically you're basically done. Now, it may not be, you may not have the maximal words, the maximal perfectly matching words, but to make sure you were finding the maximal ones, you would just look one position to the left of the position that this pointer is looking to, one position to the left, the pointer that this point, of the position that this pointer is pointing to. If those are different, then you know you cannot extend the word match by going to the left. So basically, it's just a matter of processing the list. And
this is being done on all the reads simultaneously.
Right. So
matching up.
Right. Exactly. So so I just mentioned this. So for finding matches between reads, you would concatenate all reads and their complements, make a list of pointers to all positions and all the reads. And then just working through the list, you could find all perfect matches of the given minimum length, say 25 bases or so in any two reads. So, I mean, this is, in principle, this is similar to hashing kinds of approaches and so forth, but it's quite simple and very efficient in terms of memory usage. You basically just have to create this list of pointers and don't create anything else, and then sort the pointers. So right. Okay, so you get, when you think of things in this way, the comparison problem, issue of comparing reads becomes much more computationally efficient, because it's on the order of n log n, where n, in the case of the human genome, n might be several billion. So this is a big number, but it's quite manageable with a few workstations, and it's a lot better than n squared, which is what the problem would reduce to if you wanted to compare every read to every other read using, say, Smith-Waterman alignment or even BLAST. It's really doesn't require supercomputer. This is the most computationally intensive part of sequence assembly, and it does not require supercomputers, despite what Craig Venter will tell you. Well, so you risk, if you have a number of errors, you will probably risk a small percentage of overlaps due to sequence errors, but not many. And your redundancy, assuming you're working at a reasonable redundancy, you actually don't care if you miss a few. You'll find the longer overlaps, and the cases where the reads just overlap by a few bases, you may miss, but there should be, there'll be another read with more overlap to each of those two, so you'll pick up the overlap indirectly. At any rate, and there are, in the computer science literature, there actually are more efficient methods than this that are actually linear in N, but in my opinion, they're not worth implementing because they're harder to implement. They take more memory, and you really don't gain much in terms of speed. So once you have matches, once you've identified word matches for, say, for a pair of reads, then you'd like to get an alignment between the reads to see how much overlap there really is, for example. And so that can be done. We do it just by a banded Smith-Waterman search of the matrix. And I assume you've probably seen this kind of picture in Stephen Altschul's talk or some of the other sequence comparison talks. So again, we're doing this only for selected pairs of reads, those that have perfectly matching words of a given length. And because we're doing a banded search, it's quite efficient.
I wasn't here to hear the old talk, but there's a band
is
defined by those two blue lines.
Yeah, so what I'm doing here is, so the word matches would correspond to the red lines.
Yes.
And then what we do is we define a band around each red line by going out, say, 10 bases or so in each direction. And then if you have overlapping bands, as you frequently do, because you would frequently have multiple word matches. For pair reads that really do overlap, you'll typically have multiple word matches that are separated by mismatches due to base calling errors or insertions or deletions or whatever. And so the bands overlap, you merge them and just do a search of the merged band.
And you not only have reading errors, but because the genome fragment you're looking at comes from multiple different people.
Yes. So, yeah, in a whole human genome, a whole genome shotgun of even from one individual, you'll have polymorphic differences. In the clone-by-clone approach, which is what the public sector uses, you assemble that clone. And so that's just one haplotype captured in the clone. You have no variation. You could have variation due to, you would have differences between reads due to base calling errors and occasionally due to mutations occurring in the subcloning process, but those are quite rare.
In this picture, this headline, there's two matching points. This is called two reads.
Right. Right. Well, so they might. I mean, if say one read, either because they don't really overlap or from different repeats, or because you've got base calling errors, you might have an insertion in one with respect to the other. So, in this particular situation, if you had a four base insertion in this sequence as opposed to that sequence, then you'd get a pattern like that.
Yeah.
No. I'm just talking about comparing individual reads. So this would be, maybe 700 bases, 700 rows, 700 columns on that order of comparison. Well, because the sorted list gave me the perfect word matches. But that's not enough. I want the full alignment between the reads when they do overlap, and that's why I go to this. So then I get a Smith-Waterman alignment, including gaps mismatches, and so forth.
How do you decide which reads to include?
I only do this for the reads for which I found a word match. Okay, so in the extreme, if I've got 25, say I have a 25 base word match, and it's not repeated in the genome, then or a 25 base sequence is not repeated in the genome, then I might expect, on average, to have say eight reads if it's an eightfold depth of coverage through that sequence. And so So this would cause me to compare each of those reads to the other seven. And now if you have repeats, it gets to be, it increases the number of pairs that you have to deal with. But there are things you can do up front, and you can mask out known repeats so that you don't.
But another thing is, if you set your threshold to 25 logs, then your calculation coverage, you could have with only one extension.
Yeah. Are you talking about the Lander-Waterman formula, or? Yeah, I mean, you can adjust, I mentioned that actually. You can adjust the Lander-Waterman formula for the fact that you do need a certain amount of overlap. I mean, it depends on what you're interested in. You might be interested in the actual contigs that exist, even though you may not be able to detect all the overlaps, or you might just be interested in the contigs that you can construct from the overlaps you do detect. So you can do the calculation either way. It just means you have to adjust L in one of those formulas. Yeah. And you can adjust the formula. You just have to shorten L to the read length minus the amount of that you need to detect the overlap, and the same formula holds. So we actually use just a very simple substitution matrix. You can imagine making one that's calibrated to favor the mismatches that are more likely to be seen as sequencing errors, and but it's, in general, it's not worth doing that. So we just, the penalty matrix we use, it's a plus one for a match and minus two for a mismatch, minus four for gap opening, minus three for gap extension. And that works pretty well. However, I'll mention in a second that you do need to process the reads. Or we at least process the alignments to look and see whether the differences are due to base calling errors or not. Okay, so once you've found these candidate pairwise overlaps, then the problem is to try to basically put them together and reconstruct the original sequence. What you want to do is basically map where each read occurs in the original clone that you're sequencing by virtue of these overlaps. So the main complication is that many of the overlaps that you found may not be real. They may be due to the fact that a certain sequence is actually repeated in the genome, perfectly or imperfectly. And so reads from those different copies of the repeats will appear to overlap when they don't. And this is really, it's this existence of repeats is the only thing that makes sequence assembly hard. If it weren't for repeats, it's really a trivial problem. In the human genome, there's several types of these repeated elements. It's worth listing those. One, the main type, at least in terms of numbers, is so-called selfish DNA elements, which you can think of as being like parasites or viruses that are basically, they use the cellular machinery to make copies of themselves and reinsert into the genome. Different organisms have different numbers of these. In the human genome, up to close to 50% of the DNA, actually, you can detect as being in one or another of these families. The two predominant families in humans are ALU and L1s. ALUs are about 300 bases long. L1s are, full-length L1s, I think, are 7 kb. But you also have truncated versions. But there are many, many other families. It's actually the name of a restriction enzyme that happens to have a site in the element, and so these were discovered as actually, when people digested whole human DNA and ran it out with ALU and ran it out on a gel, you see a strong band that's due to these elements. So it's not, has nothing to do with the biology. And these are in the size range of 100 or so base pairs up to 10 kb or so. It's likely, actually, although we can detect 50% of the human genome as being elements of this type, it's actually, in my opinion, probably 98% or close to 98% of the genome actually consists of these elements, but most of them have been there so long that they've picked up enough mutations that you can no longer recognize them. They seem to account for most of our genome. Most of our genome is not us. Yeah, there are some active versions that are still inserting, and they can occasionally insert into a gene and cause a genetic disease. The vast majority of them are no longer, are basically dead in the genome. ALUs, in terms of numbers, ALUs are the dominant family. There are several hundred thousand of them. However, in addition to those, there are also duplicated regions of all sizes, again, from a few hundred base pairs, but up to hundreds or possibly even megabase size regions that have become duplicated. These are not selfish DNA elements. They've been duplicated presumably just due to some kind of error in replication of the chromosomes. And these can be, because of their size, they're not as frequent as the selfish DNA elements because of their large size. They can give real problems in assembly. They're very similar to each other. What's fortunate is that most of these repeats have diverged fairly substantially from each other. I mean, basically, the first time a duplication or insertion of a selfish DNA element occurred, it was identical to a pre-existing copy. But then over time, mutations accumulate. In humans, it's roughly at a rate of one or two per billion bases per year. And so after enough time, they're diverged enough that you can tell them apart. So most repeats do have sequence differences, except for the evolutionarily most recent ones. And those do exist, and there are enough of them that they can cause problems. But at any rate, the effect of these is that apparent read overlaps are not always real, because they may be due to these repeats. So the problem is, when you have apparently overlapping reads, generally, you will see some sequence differences, and the question is, are those real, indicating that the reads are from different repeats, or are they due to base calling errors? And so we use the error probabilities that we developed for sequence. This was actually a primary motivation for introducing those, was that it allows us to evaluate alignments, and you can't distinguish in all cases the true overlaps from the false ones, but you can do a good job of sorting them out, and reasonably good job. And I won't go through the details here, but basically what we rescore an alignment. So after we've generated the banded Smith-Waterman alignment, we rescore it. Taking into account the error probabilities of the base calls, and basically compute a log likelihood ratio score that compares the probability of the data under of the alignment under the hypothesis that the reads truly do overlap versus the hypothesis that they are from distinct repeats. 95% is arbitrary. It seems to work reasonably well for distinguishing the reads that you can distinguish. You can make the assembly more stringent by increasing that. or less stringent by lowering it. But we just, it's just, we just use it as basically as a, it's a fairly arbitrary number. We use it as a way of defining this score, and empirically the score using this value works well in practice as far as discriminating the repeats that you typically come across in practice.
So this would work in the case that you've been also running on, like a clone of a single haplotype, right? You're looking at a zero or check on one or even more than one individual. You have to also add in the probability that the difference was real,
right?
But it was still a
overlap. Yeah, if you wanted to do it rigorously, that's true. On the other hand, two different haplotypes from two copies of the chromosome in the same individual or from two different individuals only differ on average one in every 1,000 base pairs or so. So the typical situation is if for a pair of aligned reads is you may have one difference that's a polymorphic difference and others that are due to base calling errors. Yeah, right. So you could build this into the probability. It actually, my guess is it wouldn't make much difference because the polymorphisms are occurring at such a low rate. Now, if you were assembling reads from that were more highly diverged, not human data, but perhaps from other organisms, other outbred organisms where the polymorphism rate is higher, it might be more important to take that into account. So anyway, the idea in constructing the layout is you sort the read pairs by decreasing LLR score and process the list in order, basically accepting a pair if it's consistent. So here's a picture to maybe make that more concrete. You think initially you've got a list of read pairs from that you've generated from your pairwise overlaps. So any given read might be involved in multiple different pairs. And then you just build up your layout by accepting in a greedy fashion by accepting pairs, starting at the top of the list, the highest scores, accepting pairs, and you have a consistency check. So in a situation like this where you've got a pair here that have an overlap, a pair here that have an overlap, but these would imply that this sequence should match this, and it doesn't, then you would reject the overlap. So fairly simple idea. And then for generating the consensus sequence, the idea sorry? Yeah, so the things you reject are going to be due to repeats, and it really depends on the DNA that you're assembling. I mean, in bacterial genomes, there are very few repeats, and so you would reject hardly anything. In human data, if you had not maxed out the alleles originally, you would have lots of these that you would reject. So actually, most of the allo matches between reads from different alleles would have low scores to begin with, because they would have real differences between them, and so they'd be far down the list. But you would also have some that were very good matches involving recent alleles, and those might be well up towards the top of the list. But they could some of them could cause a misassembly, because you might get to that a good one before you got to other overlaps in the same region that would contradict it. Generally, you don't, but you do sometimes. Yeah, I would say that's the critical phase in the assembly, and that's what you work hard to try to get it right. You want to, the criteria need to be set so that you'll reject the false overlaps, but not reject the true ones, and that it's involves, it's tricky to do that.
Would it be helpful if you have information on, say, as some course thing, like, say, if I tell you the AP composition over, say, at least 20 days window, and so then you sort of don't get identified with it?
Well, identifying the repeats is, in the simplest way to identify repeats is from sequence, direct sequence comparison. I mean, you don't want to do it on the basis of something like.
Suppose somebody gives you a picture of the entire genome at the resolution of, say, 20 or 50 base.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in some cases, repeats do have compositions that are different from the surrounding DNA, the DNA they've inserted into, but not always. Typically, when a repeat, it depends on the genome, but when a repeat first inserts, it may look different. I mean, an AT-rich repeat might insert into GC-rich part of the genome, but then over evolutionary time, it tends to pick up mutations that make it look like the surrounding DNA. So the older ones look pretty similar to the surrounding DNA. Yeah, people have tried. There are non-greedy approaches, The greedy ones, I mean, if you're careful about which overlaps you accept, it actually works as well as any other thing I know about. I mean, in principle, you ought to be able to do better with something that's not greedy. One thing that we do, have an option in our program that will carries out a greedy assembly, then looks at the assembly you've got, for does various consistency checks, and if it finds potential errors or potential alternative joins, it breaks the assembly, but it breaks it into pieces, into what are generally fairly large pieces, and then it considers all possible ways of attaching, reattaching those to each other. So if you don't have too many pieces, you can basically do an exhaustive search for all possible ways of joining those up. And there are other kinds of approaches that people have tried, using simulated annealing or other kinds of heuristic methods for searching the space, searching the layout space. But it's the greedy approach actually works pretty well. It does occasionally make errors, but generally. The simplest way to deal with the errors is that at the finishing stage, when somebody has to look at the data anyway for purposes of additional data collection, they can easily see the misassemblies and just correct them manually. And you only need to do that for a few percent of clones, so it's not a big deal. But there are potential improvements in doing the assembly. I'm not so interested in this anymore, so I'm not really continuing to work on those kinds of ideas, but I'm sure some people are. Well, that's a complicated issue. Maybe I am going to talk about cellular assembly later, so maybe I should get to that point. It probably is true that Solaris sequence is does a better job of ordering and orienting pieces because they use the paired read information more systematically than it was in the public project. But what you see in those pictures, it's actually hard to interpret those pictures. That some of the differences you're seeing are just very, very large segments in the public assembly, big contigs that have that are flipped with respect to the Solera assembly. And in some cases, Solera is probably right. In other cases, the public sector is probably right. But at any rate, so getting back to the assembly issues, so given a strategy of that type, the question is how big a region is it feasible to attack? And the main issue is not really the size of the genome, because we can handle large data sets, but the repeat character of the genome, because the repeat character is going to strongly determine how reliable your final assembly is. The repeats greatly increase the risk of misassembling regions. So bacterial genomes and small eukaryote genomes have relatively few repeats. They're actually quite easy to assemble correctly. Mammalian genomes have many repeats. On the other hand, they're distributed in kind of a complex fashion. Some of them, as I mentioned, are very large and evolutionarily very recent. It's a very different story from the smaller genomes. And the general principle is, in a mammalian genome, the larger the region is that you want to assemble, the more likely it is to contain highly similar repeats. So basically, the complexity, if you like, goes up quadratically in the size of the region that you want to assemble, because the that's how the probability of having repeats goes. So the main options one can contemplate are, for a large genome, are going either clone by clone, and this has been the preferred method in the public sector, where you first make a map of overlapping large clones, and in the public sector, the clones that people tend to work with these days are BACs, bacterial artificial chromosomes, which are generally 150 kb to 200 kb in size, and then you sequence those clones one by one. The alternative approach is to generate your shotgun data from the whole genome at once, and then assemble that. All I mean by that is figure out how the clones overlap each other and where they are on the chromosome. Now you actually don't need to make much of a map in order to do that, or you can make the map as you go, generate sequence data from BACs, and then if it overlaps BACs that you've already sequenced, you can detect that. If it doesn't overlap them, then it sort of nucleates a new position in the map. But yes, and they use a variety of methods. To make maps, you can use their marker maps, that where you have genetic markers, other types of markers, which are generally you have small DNA segments that you can place on the chromosome by one method or another, genetic mapping, radiation hybrid mapping. And then you can pull, once you have a small DNA sequence, you can make PCR primers, screen a BAC library, pull out BACs that overlap that sequence, and then you've got a collection of BACs that are all mapped to a particular location in the genome, namely the location where the marker was originally. The other widely used strategy, which is really the main mapping method for the BACs in the public effort, is to fingerprint BACs, which involves doing restriction digests with particular restriction enzymes. It gives you a pattern of fragments of particular sizes. And then you compare the restriction fragment patterns among all the BACs to find ones that appear to share number of fragments of a certain size, and then you put those together. It's not a perfect process. I mean, these big duplicated regions can make it as hard to make a reliable map as they do to make it hard to get the sequence right in some cases. But generally, because you're working with big, fairly large segments in these backs, the map tends to be reasonably accurate up to certain ambiguities. Sure, that's fine.
Okay. So I mentioned these main approaches, which are the clone by clone approach, where you first, which basically allows you to partition the problem, modularize the problem, if you like, by first getting a set of clones where you know their positions, or actually you can work that out as you go simultaneously with the sequencing, which is really what was done in the public sector project, versus the whole genome approach. So Celera is famous for pushing the whole genome approach largely an inventor when he was at Tiger first did a whole bacterial genome by this approach. Although, as I mentioned, bacterial genomes are not that difficult to assemble. And then more recently, Gene Myers, who is now at Celera, and Jim Weber argued that this would be a good way to do the whole human genome. So there are a number of things that they do. I'll mention later some of the assembly refinements that they use. But the main thing, the main idea, which is actually not due to, Center takes credit for it, but it's not, it was actually invented in 1990 by a German group. Genomic sequencing at the time, but the main idea is to make heavy use of paired reads. The advantage that gives you with respect to assembly is if you have a pair of reads, then that gives you, as I mentioned, two sequence tracks for which you know the approximate spacing, if you know the clone insert size, and and you know the relative orientations of the reads they're pointing towards each other. So that will allow you to bridge some repeats, depending on how big the clone is from which you obtain this pair of reads. If it's a 10 kb or so clone, then you get a pair of reads that are 10 kb apart from each other. That gives you the ability, in principle, to leap over repeats that are shorter than 10 kb, even if they're perfect repeats, because you get a pair of reads on, you can, with the right clone, you could get a pair of reads that are on either side of the repeated region. So that's actually a big help in the assembly. And although it's an old idea, it really became most effective with these the capillary gel sequencers, mainly because with the slab gel sequencing machines, keeping track of which read came from which clone was actually an issue. There are one type of error that you see in data from the older sequencing instruments is so-called lane tracking errors, where you get a read that's comes from a lane in the gel, but due to the fact that you've got lanes very densely packed on the gel, you occasionally have mix-ups in the clone ID that's attached to a lane and the actual data. So with older data, the pair information is frequently corrupted by those lane tracking errors. But with the capillaries, that occurs much less frequently because each lane is run, each read comes from a single capillary, so you know you know exactly where it's come from. It's much looser. There's still ways you could mix up data and misplace the labels, but it's much less likely to occur. At any rate, the read pair information is important. The main argument that's what are the issues? Why would you want to do a whole genome approach? But what are the advantages of doing a big segment versus a little segment? The main advantage that's been put forward, the main argument that's been put forward is that it should be less costly because you shouldn't have to do any mapping. You should have to make fewer of the subclone libraries, those libraries that have the DNA templates that you actually sequence. At some level, in whenever you clone DNA, there are things that can go wrong. You can have rearrangements in the DNA, for example. So, whereas in the clone-by-clone process, you need two cloning steps. You need there's a cloning step involved in making the backs, and then a subcloning step in making the subclones from each back. In the whole genome shotgun approach, you only have one cloning step. So you may reduce some errors. In fact, this turns out to be not really such a big advantage because backs, people have developed the back cloning technology to the point where the backs are actually quite reliable. There is a few percent of backs who do have the arrangements that occur when you're making the clones. However, when you make a map, particularly a fingerprint type map, the sort I mentioned, you detect most of those because you see inconsistencies in the fingerprint. So you get it back, the fingerprint does not fit anywhere in the map, and discard that. At any rate, that's turned out to be not such a big advantage, and the main argument is the cost. Now, the counter argument is that the cost savings is actually fairly trivial because making subclone libraries and mapping is not a big percentage of the cost of sequencing. It's less than 10% of the cost. The main sequencing cost is in generating the read data. And by doing the whole genome approach, you do not reduce the number of reads you need to do. In fact, if anything, to get an equivalently accurate sequence, you probably need to do more reads. So it's probably more expensive. But beyond that, to the extent that you do save the mapping in the subclone libraries up front, you almost completely lose that and pay it back later at the finishing stage. Because if it turns out, as I'll talk about for the Drosophila project, which Solera points to as their big success, they still needed map clones, and they needed to make subclone libraries from the clones in order to do the finishing. So if your goal is to get a finished, highly accurate sequence, all they're doing is deferring costs for the whole genome approach. They're not saving them. They're just pushing them to later in the project. And the other issue is that there's a significant risk of failure. So even because assembly is a much bigger issue, it's much harder when the bigger the genome is, the more repeats you have. So Solera has sort of, in their PR, they kind of obfuscated this whole the whole argument here. They claim that there are big cost savings without ever providing any cost data, and it's just it does not make sense that there are cost savings because of these reasons. And then they claim that the only issue is whether the assembly succeeds. And so that's overlooking the part that even if the assembly does succeed, you're really not saving much. And there's a big risk that it won't succeed. So, yeah. It's not quicker. I mean, the quickness with which you can get it done depends on your sequencing capacity. So that's another way in which they've totally obfuscated the discussion of this in the in the media. The reason Celera was able to go so quickly is because they got this huge sequencing capacity right off through their, because they were set up as a sister company to Applied Biosystems, which makes these capillary sequencers. And they got the first sequencing machines from that company. The public sector has been generating data actually at a higher rate now. In fact, they've generated more data for the human genome than Celera has. And they've done it on a clone-by-clone basis, and they covered the whole genome as fast or faster than Celera did. So it's a little, if you're going clone-by-clone, it is harder to manage in the sense that you have to have a group that's turning out these subclone libraries at a reasonable rate. But you can't, you don't go faster with the whole genome shotgun. Now, it is true that with the whole genome, if you're generating sequences from the whole genome, you do get some sequence data from everywhere in the genome almost immediately. But in terms of the finishing point, how long does it take you to get to the final finished sequence, it does not save you any time. And in fact, there's a significant risk that it will delay you because it will be harder to finish. So again, Celera basically used, the real issue is they had this huge sequencing capacity, and they gave people the impression that the reason they were able to deal with Drosophila so quickly was because of their approach. But in fact, it's not the approach, it's the sequencing capacity. And now that the public sector has equivalent capacity, they're sequencing at the same rate. At any rate, so the first genome that they did was Drosophila. It's about 120 megabase genome. Actually, the total genome size is more like 180 megabases, but about 60 megabases of it is so-called heterochromatin, which is very highly repetitive sequence. The way the sequencing was done, they made libraries from the whole genome that were constructed in such a way that it excluded the heterochromatin. So effectively, they were sequencing 120 megabase genome that excludes the heterochromatin. This was a very favorable case for their approach, and it's fairly obvious that they had a big PR. Company had a big PR stake on this succeeding, so they did things. They chose the organism carefully, and Drosophila has very low repeat density. It's 5% or less, and it appears to have no large duplicated regions now that we have the assembly. Now, it could be that actually there are large duplicated regions, and Celera has collapsed them in their assembly. That's certainly possible, but. It doesn't. In any case, it does not seem to be. It's nowhere near as bad as the human genome. The other thing they did, which was quite smart to get their approach to succeed, was to do it to a very high depth of coverage. It's almost 15-fold, which is about twice as deep as you normally do in a clone-by-clone approach. And that's expensive. I mean, it basically doubles the cost of the project relative to a clone-by-clone approach. Nonetheless, what they wound up with was a sequence where there are gaps about every 50 kb, which is much more frequent than you would expect at 15x coverage. At 15x coverage, there only should have been about 10 gaps or so in the whole genome. But they had them. They had several thousand of them every 50 kb, and it's this suggests to me that probably, and this was one of the concerns with the whole genome shotgun approach, is that when you make a library from the whole genome, well, sequence characteristics of the genome vary a lot. In the human genome, you've got GC-rich regions, you've got AT-rich regions. More extreme than many other organisms, but you also have variation in repeat density and so forth. And so it's very hard to make a library that actually samples the whole genome uniformly. And I think part of the issue with this gap frequency is that the library, the whole genome shotgun library, did in fact have biases in coverage, and that's why they got very many more gaps than they should have. Also, there were misassemblies. Something that did not get very well publicized, certainly in the press and acknowledged by the authors. But if you read the paper carefully, they're basically getting a misassembly. They're judging from a particular region they looked at carefully, and actually that may be an unusually favorable region. They get a misassembly about every 220 kb. Now these are the misassemblies in this region, at least, they're all local. Most of them involve repeats. Some of them are collapses of gene families, but they didn't produce any gross rearrangements in the sequence, at least in this region. Yeah, they're reads. They're regions of sequence joined together that actually don't belong together. And that can happen. There are a variety of ways that can happen. But in these cases, most of the misassemblies occurred within repeats. And they just got regions inverted or collapsed. Several copies collapsed. There are a variety of different things. And they did not actually tell us in the paper. They didn't enumerate all the different things that occurred, but they did. They did give data that allowed people that they did have misassemblies about that frequency. And then there are a few genes, mostly in their heterochromatic region. So embedded within the heterochromatin, you have regions of that are single copy, but those don't always clone very well with the approach to making libraries that they use, so that some of those are missing. Given this, that you have a gap every 50 kb, which is several gaps per back, and a misassembly about every back and a half, basically to finish the sequence, which involves filling in the gaps, correcting the misassemblies, you basically have to work with a complete tiling path of backs that covers the whole genome. And the way that's being done by Jerry Rubin's lab at Berkeley and the other labs who are involved is they make shotgun library from each back. They map the Celera reads to the back and combine it with shotgun data generated from the back, reassemble each back to identify misassemblies, and then they use directed gap closure using the back. So all the predicted cost savings that were attributed to this strategy have been lost because they have to make a map. They have to make libraries for each of the backs to get to the finished sequence. So plus they had to do 15x coverage. So it clearly is much more expensive to have done it this way. Now it did happen quickly, but as I said, it happened quickly because of the huge capacity that they assembled. Yeah, they were there, and a couple of others, I think Richard Gibbs at Baylor, and. It's possible with DO. I don't know. I think there are one or two other labs.
Sorry? In terms of the stuff that you know, the people to not scaffold
I have no idea. It's they are working through the backs. There's a lot of work to do because they have to cover the whole genome. They have three backs, three gaps on average per back, and they have to do backs for the whole genome. And it's a slow process. And when they published their paper last year, they talked about having it basically finished by the end of the year, which was a wildly optimistic prediction, I think. And I don't know how close they are now, but they, I think there's still a lot of work to do.
This book was expensive.
Hmm?
And you finished it?
No, the Gisalva sequence is not finished.
No.
Right. Exactly. Which makes sense for a company because, you do get, actually in the first few X of shotgun coverage, you can identify fragments of most genes and you can apply the patents on those, which they did. I don't think they did with the software, but they have with the human data. And so it's expensive to finish the job. They don't have really much, if any, financial incentive to do it.
Does it mean that the gaps that you which create a huge mess in the whole genome, if you don't get this faster than that, that these gaps occur at most of the time in non-coding genes, so they get more or less?
I'm not sure how they break down. Certainly many of the gaps are in repeats, but I don't know in percentage terms. So some of the gaps may not actually be true gaps in their coverage, but simply places where their assembly basically had to stop because it couldn't do the assembly reliably. Some of the gaps are in coding sequence. There certainly, I've not worked with a Drosophila sequence myself, but I've talked to a number of people and they frequently encounter situations where part of the gene is missing, even with it falls into a gap. And,
Is sequencing
very
different?
Like,
you
No, I think, to the extent that the last part is sort of, you're enriched for repeat sequences, sequencing by hybridization is probably the last thing you'd want to try because it works very, that's a big complication with sequencing by hybridization is that it really can't deal with repeats. It might help you, I don't know. I'm not sure if it would be useful at all in attention safety. Okay, so for the human genome, they generated it's a lot more data, but the depth of coverage was a lot less. They estimate about 5.1x coverage, it should be 5.1x. And actually that's probably optimistic because I think they underestimate the genome size. And it's probably actually a little less than 5x coverage. But then they combine that with the public data, about 2.9x, they say, shredded public data, and I'll talk about what that is in a minute and why. And then also they used there's a fairly large data set of several hundred thousand facts for which end reads have been generated from both ends of the back insert. So those are paired reads that are separated by a very substantial difference of 150 kb or so. And those are actually useful. Unfortunately, there's, because of tracking errors, a number of the pairs are substantial percentage of the pairs are not correct. They're not correctly paired with each other, but nonetheless, it's useful data for potentially for bridging large repeats. Their data was generated mostly in paired read forms from clones of three different sizes, 2 kb, 10 kb, and 50 kb, with the idea that it could be used for bridging repeats. They don't actually use the read pairs in assembly, except in kind of a trivial way. People have talked about doing an entire assembly using the read pair information up front. And I actually don't know of anybody who's doing that. Myers does not do it in this whole genome assembly program. But he does use the read pairs for the occasionally allow him to walk into the gap where you have or a region where you haven't been able to assemble it due to the repeat nature, but the fact that one or more reads you have there are paired with reads in the rest of the config may give you information that you can use to improve the assembly reliability. So he does that occasionally, but the main use of the read pairs is to link up configs position them with respect to each other, order and orient them. So if you have the idea is if you have read near, if you have a read near the end of a config, and there's the other read with which it's paired that was generated from the same subclone falls into near the end of another config, then you can position those configs with respect to each other. Generally, you want to have two read pairs because there is an error rate in the read pairing even with the capillary machine. And so you get you can order and orient groups of configs, and a group of configs that are ordered and oriented is called a scaffold. So what they wind up with is a collection of scaffolds that each scaffold consisting of one or more configs, this is what they produce as their sequence assembly. They also do use the read pair information as a check on the assembly accuracy, and it's actually quite useful for that purpose. Myers' approach he does some things. It's sort of a greedy assembly approach, like the one I described. But he does the assembly in a more cautious way to try to avoid incorrectly putting together reads from different repeats. So there's several things. He screens out known repeats and doesn't allow you to make joins or use read overlaps that fly entirely within repeats. You basically only extend configs up to the point where there are no conflicting read information. So if you have a pair of reads, either of which could be joined to a given read, but they diverge in sequence from each other. So there's an inconsistency or ambiguity as to which read you should match. Then he stops the config assembly at that point because it's an indication that you're dealing with repeats. So he produces a set of unitigs that are called that are likely to be single copy sequence, set of repeat configs that are probably collapsed versions of repeated segments. And then there's a substantial fraction of the reads cannot be assembled in at all. They call this chaff. It's actually 25% of their reads. Some of this is reads that fall entirely within known repeats, so they don't want to assemble it with anything else. Some of it is probably contamination from other sequencing projects that they're carrying out, and or potentially rearranged clones or other problematic clones. Then the large scaffolds that they get, if the scaffolds are large enough, then they can be mapped to the genome using the public sector maps. And basically, you want to have a scaffold that has at least 100 kb of sequence in it to have a high chance that there are identifiable markers in the sequence that can be used for mapping. Small scaffolds, there's no way to place in the genome unless you do some very tedious mapping procedure like developing a PCR assay from the sequence, screening the library or screening map sets of clones to then place it in the map. It's just a very small scaffold. You cannot place it without doing a lot of work. So the real issue is how much of the genome do they get in large scaffolds. So I mentioned that they use the shredded, they take the public data that they get from GenBank, which includes finished sequence and draft sequence that is partially assembled backs. And they, what they do is they shred that up into 550 base pair segments with 275 base pair perfect overlap. So the idea is, and the way they present this in the paper, it's like getting another twofold shotgun coverage. You're producing, you don't record where in the genome the shredded sequence comes from. The sequence length is about the length of the read. The idea is that they want to combine this with their own data and treat it as if it was just sort of an enlarged shotgun, so an additional 2x shotgun coverage. The problem is that's extremely misleading because this perfect shredding gives you much more information about the original assembly than twofold shotgun coverage would. Basically, if you have 2x shotgun coverage, you get an average config size of 2 kb or so using the Lander-Waterman formula. But instead, by shredding the data, including the finished sequence, what they get is basically enough information to completely reconstruct the original contiguous sequence that was shredded. So it's not in any way equivalent to two-fold shotgun coverage, 2x shotgun coverage. In fact, we've shown that. I mean, we've taken chromosome 21 and shredded it up in the same way that Celera did, and reassembled just the shredded data. And we actually get an assembly that's as good as what they report their chromosome 21 assembly to have been, even though their chromosome assembly, their chromosome 21 assembly actually included both the shredded data and their own data. So it's clear that they're getting enormous information from this shredded sequence. Basically, it's capturing nearly all the information in the individual local back assemblies. And so it's just false to say that this is in any way equivalent to whole genome shotgun data. It is not. Well, they do that. They have kind of a tricky PR issue, which is basically the whole genome approach failed, but they want to present it as if it were a success, and they also want to produce the best sequence that they possibly can. So they talk about two assemblies in their paper. One is a compartmentalized shotgun assembly, in which they map their reads to the public backs and then do regional assemblies that may extend over several backs, but they basically use the public back sequences to localize their reads to a particular region of the genome, and then they just do a local assembly in that region. So that they call a compartmentalized shotgun assembly. That includes the shredded sequence, the shredded public sequence, and it's also clearly just making heavy use of the map, the public map, because the public map localizes all these facts, and that's how they know where their assembly goes. The other assembly they do, they call a whole genome assembly, I call it a faux whole genome assembly because it's not a whole genome assembly. It uses their data plus what they call faux reads, which are these shredded reads that retain the local assembly information. In addition to using the public data in that in the shredded form, they also use actually the assembled back config. I actually missed this the first time I read the paper because in one sentence in the paper, they gloss over it. But I think this actually might have been quite important. They use the assembled back config from the public data to close gaps. So when their assembly reaches a point where it stops because it's encountering repeats or some region that they lack data for, then they take actually the entire assembled back config, not even in shredded form, and use that to bridge the gap if they can. So this supposed whole genome assembly is really using the Celera data and the pulse reads. There's not one word in the paper of a true whole genome assembly of their own data. Although Dean Myers has frequently talked about how 6x coverage is perfectly adequate to do a whole genome assembly. They did that with Drosophila and claimed that they got as good an assembly with 6x as they did with 15x. Not as good, but it was still accurate. And so they've clearly done it with their own 5x or 5x plus data, but they don't say one word about it, which means to me says that the results they got were unacceptable. But beyond that, in my opinion, even the faux whole genome assembly results from that were totally unacceptable. If you read the data that's presented in their paper, there's 14% of the genome is not assembled at all, and an additional 8% is in 100,000 small scaffolds that are about 2 kb in size. There's no way you're going to map those back to the genome. And so you've got almost a quarter of the genome that's either not assembled or it's unmappable, it's unplaceable in the genome. That's failure by anybody's definition. The assembly, they don't actually, beyond giving you data from which you can infer these numbers, they actually don't talk about the whole genome assembly in terms of its accuracy and so forth. They mainly talk about the compartmentalized shotgun assembly. Just to summarize, no, they didn't save any money because they need using this approach. Because they saved their own money because they could use the public sector data, but they didn't. They did not avoid by this approach any of the steps that you need in a clone by clone sequencing project. They needed the full public sector mapping information to map their scaffolds back to the genome. The small scaffolds they would not be able to place. Even with that mapping information, and they still needed local sequence assembly. They used the shredded data and so forth, which contains the local sequence information. And then beyond that, even with the assembly did actually fail after all. Instead, it's not a true full genome assembly. So anyway, I guess I'll stop here. But to me, it's interesting how things have played out in the press because they've been actually very successful at giving the impression that Celera's has been very successful at generating a whole genome map that sequence that it's actually better than the public sector sequence, and that it's dependent on this innovative new approach that just shortcut all the steps that were needed in the public sector effort, and none of that is true. The approach didn't fail, it's pretty disturbing to me that that they've been successful at creating an impression of in the press and even in the scientific community that they succeeded when actually they did. Now the issue of the actual sequence they produce using the compartmentalized shotgun assembly and how that compares to the public sector sequence is, that's a separate issue. It certainly should be a better sequence than the public sector sequence because they used all the public sector sequence. In fact, there was more public sector data than they had generated themselves. And then they combined their own data with that. And so certainly they ought to be able to come up with something that's better. And it does look as though it's improved, it's a better sequence in terms of ordering and orienting context. It actually has gaps at about the same rate as the public sector sequence. Sequence context may be ordered and oriented more reliably. It's hard to tell, partly because the comparison they did in their paper was to an older version of the public assembly. And I think that newer versions of the assembly may well be more accurate on the public side. But the other issue is that the public sector sequence is going to be tended to hoping to, and it's sort of a transient difference at best because more data is being generated on the public side. Hopefully it'll be finished within another couple of years and by later this year, actually, enough additional sequence data will have been generated that it will be the ordering and orienting of the context will be pretty thoroughly straightened out. There was some other stuff. I was going to talk about gene predictions in the human genome, but I better stop because that would take me to another line.
Okay, thank you.
Well, so actually,
my only, we haven't been trying to predict genes in the human genome using the methods I described yesterday. It's clearly a harder problem, but we have been interested in assembling ESTs and using those as a tool to predict genes. The main thing I actually wanted to talk about in this talk was just how we got an estimate last year. It was published last year for gene number in the human genome. We got an estimate of 35,000 genes. Genter, in his usual fashion, presented the low gene number as a surprising new discovery that contradicted previous estimates, which is misrepresentation of the literature. A couple of other groups also published papers last year pointing to a low gene number. But I think I'll publish that. It's published work and I'm not sure we really get into it. Chris.
Have you seen the
Polaris
sequence or the
MCU? No. I'm reluctant to sign their licensing agreement. Although it occurred to me, I think there's a way you could actually. So, if you want to get access to their whole genome sequence, you have to sign this agreement that you're not going to redistribute it. You're not going to publish any of the sequence. What you can do, you can publish genome features with or the coordinates of genome features, and then have a link. A link to their site, so that somebody could read your list of coordinates, and then if they want the actual Solaris sequence, they could go to the Solaris site and get access to it based on your license agreement. But it occurred to me that one type of genome feature is just the occurrence of a short word, like ECG. My reading of the license agreement is that it would actually be perfectly legal to publish a list of the occurrences of all four nucleotide words in the Solaris sequence. You wouldn't publish the sequence itself, but you'd say what the word was and then get the positions. So I have a feeling here lawyers would be troubled for anybody who tried that.
Do you think it's at all worthwhile?
I'm skeptical. I guess it's a cost benefit. I mean, it's a little bit better than the public data. Not much better, and the public assembly is improving with each iteration and with accumulation of data. So it's not. I'm skeptical that it's worth doing much for that. Now you can if you pay, you know, if you give them money, you can also get access to their mouse data, which might be quite useful, although the mouse data is coming along in the public sector as well. They're already at 2x coverage in the public sector for the mouse genome, and you get the 3x in another couple of months. Which is, well, I guess Solera says they have 5x coverage for the mouse, but I don't know. I mean, it's, I personally don't think it's worth paying them $1,000 a year, which is whatever it takes for an individual investigator to do.
You also have these single data.
Sorry?
Single meter data.
Right. Yeah, and that's, but again, there are also lots of SNPs in the public sector, which the consortium has identified, I think, a couple million SNPs now. So there'll be some that are in Solera's data that are not in the public data. Whether it's enough additional ones that it's worth sending us to the data. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. I mean, certainly the part that they're missing is going to be enriched for repetitive DNA. It's not all repetitive DNA. It does include single copy sequence. And so, I might guess. So if you take the entire what they've assembled. In their compartmentalized shotgun assembly, then it looks like that has 88% or 90% roughly of the single copy sequence in the genome. They got that estimate by taking marker sequences. Which are single copy, mapped marker sequences, which are single copy, comparing those to their assembly, and they about 90% of them get a little less than 90%. So that's in their best, in their compartmentalized shotgun assembly. So I would guess that probably about 90% of the single copy sequence is present in their sequence, and that presumably includes, you know, most of it. Some of the proteome is encoded in duplicated genes and so forth, but it's probably about the fraction of the proteome that's present. On the other hand, the fraction of genes that are present should be higher than that, because or that are partially present, because you could have part of the gene present, part of it missing, and you still count that as being included, and they may well have 95% of the genes or so. At least partially represented. But the numbers for the public sector data are comparable. 90% of the sequence in the assembly. There's not a big difference in coverage between the Solera and the public sequence content.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know. I mean, 2 kb is not gonna give you entire genes. Undoubtedly pieces of genes that fall into those. It may well be that in the very short time thing, which may not be very well covered by means of sequence accuracy, may be lower. So the gene prediction reliability or homolog detection may be less efficient.
Yeah,
chromosomes
issue, I guess, better for those sequences.
Best done? Well, the ones that are finished are 21 and 22. I think 14 is close to being finished. They actually hoped to have it finished last year. And chromosome 7 is pretty close. That's chromosome that our genome center, as well as the WAQ genome center, have worked on. I don't know. There's sort of scattered around. I think there are a lot of 17 that's done. I haven't really been monitoring that. I mean, I think you can tell from the NCBI website, they have these little chromosome pictures. In fact, didn't you show one yesterday, Chris?
Yeah, that was a screenshot.
Yeah, so that told you, the color code told you which, how much of it was finished versus how much was in draft form.
Okay, so we'll give you more discussions tonight. Thanks, Bill.